Welcome, everyone, to episode 363 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Zaporik, and today we are going to catch up on the conference finals. We are heading into game 5 of the Western Conference Finals and game 6 of the East, so we'll get caught up on all those. And we will also address my beloved, hated 76ers and their apparent attempt to hire Mike D'Antoni to maybe, hopefully, lure James Harden in 2 years. Before we get into all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is the man who is going to get me into Denmark in January, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
It's going okay, Brian. My youngest is teething, meaning that we're not getting a whole lot of sleep here these days. So that's on a downside. But you know, on the flip side, he's getting teeth, which is positive, I guess.
It's a good sign of human development. So I guess that is good. But I'm glad you guys figured out what was going on with him. That must be a big relief, if nothing else.
Oh yeah, yeah. Having a kid who has a high fever, who's, you know, just over a year old, who can't communicate, is literally the worst, because you just don't know what the hell it is that he wants or needs, or what's wrong. It was simply because he started grabbing by his teeth, and we're like, okay, something is going on there. And then we opened up his mouth, and we saw deep inside in one of his gums something was breaking through, and that's gotta hurt. I don't remember anything about that period, thankfully. But I'm pretty sure that's. I mean, it makes sense, right? Having teeth break through your gums doesn't sound pleasant.
No, that does not sound ideal for sure. But yeah, I mean, I don't have a kid yet, but I can only assume having a baby is like having a dog, where it's like when anything is wrong, you're just like, talk to me, but you can't. So we need to figure out another way to figure out what's wrong with you. And it can be very frustrating. But yeah, I'm glad to hear you guys got to the bottom of it.
I appreciate it. And just a piece of advice. So never tell Alex, or never compare a potential kid to a dog in front of your wife.
Right,
just,
right.
That's something guys do. And then when the wife hears it, you get that look where you're like, uh-oh, I said something I shouldn't have said.
I've told her, I've kept the dog alive, so whenever we have a baby, that is her job. I will sub in 5% of the time, as she has done with the dog. I think it's only a fair balance of power.
That would be perfect. That would, yes, I would agree with that. That seems very reasonable, and certainly not something that would end in divorce.
Absolutely. Right, right. All right, let's get into some basketball talk. We had game 5 of Boston-Miami last night, and I honestly thought today was going to be the second by Felicia for the Celtics. I mean, the first half, they looked completely disinterested. They were completely out of sync offensively. Miami seemed to be running away with it, and then the third quarter came, and Boston just blew them out of the water. So now we have a real series on our hands. We're going into a game 6. You know, and I think Boston should feel pretty confident given how well they responded in that second half of game 5. Do you think they figured something out about Miami last night that should give them confidence about their ability to, you know, pull a Denver and go from a 3-1 deficit to win a series?
I don't know if they figured them out, but I definitely think they caught fire, and then they found a way to keep that fire going, which I think has been a problem otherwise this series. So for them to actually maintain a run and build upon it and actually close that run out with a win, that has to be some sort of stepping stone into a larger understanding of, okay, this is the path that we're going to take to beat Miami. I don't know if they have the final solution to the Heat, because the Heat are so damn good on both ends of the court and on the glass when Adebayo is just, you know, really active on there. So I don't think you can necessarily figure Miami out, because they can give you so many different looks. But for the Celtics, I think it was more a question of them looking internally instead of looking at Miami and trying to fix certain things, like trying to gauge what they're doing. I think for Boston, it was just sort of this wake-up call where they kind of realized, oh, hell, we're actually a really good basketball team. We can do some damage on both ends of the floor because we're really, really good. So let's utilize that and let's see how far we can take this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, Tatum obviously played extremely well. He didn't have a scoreless first half like he did in game four, finished with 31, 10, and 6. The thing that stood out to me in game five was the play of the centers. I mean, Daniel Theis had 15 points, 13 rebounds, 3 blocks. Even Enes Kanter came off the bench, only played 10 minutes, but gave him 8 points, 4 rebounds, and really seemed to make kind of an immediate impact. As that second quarter went on, we started to see, you know, I think he missed a couple bunnies and then gave up a few defensive possessions on the other end, which he is wont to do. But, you know, he kind of stymied. Miami looked like they were about to run away with this thing in the first and second quarter, and then he kind of stymied that momentum and kept Boston within striking distance, at least. So, you know, do you think that's kind of the play moving forward for Boston? Is like, we just need to, you know, they have that best, quote unquote, the best five lineup, which is their three wings, Kemba and Marcus, which, you know, super switchable. All five guys are 3-point threats. But when you're going against someone like Bam, do you think, you know, they have more confidence now? Okay, we can have a center in and we can win that matchup.
Yeah, on some level, yes. So you know, you and I have talked about this so many times before, but when you have centers who aren't defensively inclined, but who can still produce a significant portion of points and rebounds in limited minutes, like Enes Kanter, you know, he does serve a purpose, even if he's not necessarily a great defender. So he's a big body. If he can take rebounds away from Bam, that's an asset. That is suddenly an asset, even though he might give up some points on the other end. You know, if he scores and if he's rebounding and he's making sure that the Celtics are getting these additional possessions, that's a win. I mean, let me just read you some numbers here. Enes Kanter in this series has played 27 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just over one half of basketball. And yet he has 21 points and 14 rebounds. And five of them are offensive. So that is just the type of production you in playoff context just need sometimes. I think coaches at some point just gets a little bit too caught up in the whole, oh, we have a player in there who might give up some points defensively. Well, yeah, that can absolutely happen, and that's why you limit that player's minutes, but that player still serves a purpose if he's producing on a high, you know, if he offers production offensively and on the glass. For Kanter, you know, this could be him swinging the series for Boston if he just gets a little bit more run. If he gets a little bit more freedom to score, if he's able to take away some pretty big rebounds, you know, that should be enough, because you have Marcus Smart, you have Jason Tatum, you have Jaylen Brown, you have these guys who are very, very strong defenders. So you got to ask yourself, like, are we really sacrificing the entire defense to the same extent just by having Enes Kanter in there, or can we live with that for a stretch while we just optimize the offensive production? I think the question should be yes, or the answer should be yes, rather.
Yeah. And I mean, I wonder, you know, we talked a lot throughout the playoffs really about having versatility, having, you know, teams are going to take away your number one option, and can you come up with a counterpunch, and like, can you keep defenses off balance? And so should Enes Kanter be playing 30 minutes per game in this series? Absolutely not, because we saw, you know, as good as he was and as good as his per minute numbers are, you know, you see the downside. I mean, Miami starts to target him in every single pick and roll, as well they should. Like, he is not a good pick and roll defender, and he will be a liability on that end of the court. But if you can put him in limited minutes and he can give you, you know, a couple buckets and a couple rebounds in that span, and that can help you bridge the gap between when some of your starters are off the court and when they can come back, that's invaluable. I mean, that's the point of role players. Like, not every player needs to put up 20 points and 10 rebounds a game. If they can just, you know, keep a lead not from ballooning on the other end while they're on the floor, that produces value. So, you know, do I think Enes Kanter is the key to this series moving forward? No. I mean, for Boston's sake, I hope not. But I do think they got valuable minutes out of him last night. I would assume Brad Stevens is going to go back to him at some point during game six. You know, I think they can only hope that Tice is as valuable last night moving forward as he was last night, because that was one of his better games of the series, I would argue. You know, if they can play Bam to somewhat of a standstill with the combination of Tice and Cantor, that's an enormous win for Boston. I mean, Bam has been phenomenal in this series. You know, you have to wonder at this point, it seemed like he hurt his wrist, I think, toward the end of game four. He was kind of holding that left arm, you know, right. Clearly was not trying to draw contact with it. He says he's fine. And he's still, you know, game five, he had 13 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists. Not like he had a bad game, but I think game four he had, 27 and 16, was it? Something like that? Or was that game? That might have been game three. Yeah, game four he had 20 and 12. But even still, you know, if you're points-wise, if you are playing Bam evenly, like Tice and Bam scored the same number of points last night, that is an enormous win for Boston.
Right. By the way, would there be a better center for Boston specifically than Bam Adebayo?
No.
Right?
Yeah, definitely not.
I had someone reach out to me on Twitter and basically ask me, so this isn't related to anything, but theoretically, wouldn't Bam just be the perfect center to complete that Celtics lineup? I was like, huh, yeah, he would be. That would arguably be the best team in the league. Like that would he would fit in seamlessly. I found that pretty interesting. I hadn't thought about it.
I feel like
you're absolutely right.
I feel like you could say that about most teams in the league. Like Bam is the archetype of center that's only going to become more popular. Like, who would you rather have right now in a vacuum, Bam Adebayo or Karl Anthony Towns?
Bam, for sure.
Which is, I mean, that sounds, you know, kind of ridiculous on the surface because, like, Towns is a 25 and 12 guy, but then, you know, you look at what Bam provides on both ends of the court, and yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Like, if I'm building a team around a center, I would want someone as versatile as Bam, whereas, you know, Towns is a great player. I think he's, you know, become almost underrated because people focus so much on the defensive shortcomings instead of what he provides offensively. But, you know, if you're building a team around a center and that center is not a great rim protector, then that's a problem.
So I actually wrote an article about Bam on Danish TV2 the other day. And in my research, I discovered something, which was essentially, you know, Miami fans are banking on the fact that Bam's shot will translate into becoming a three-point shot, even as, you know, as early as next season, maybe, because the mechanics are there. He's already a good foul shooter. When he takes mid-range jump shots, they seem to be very fluid. So there is a sense of expectation, if you will, about him becoming ultimately a three-point shooter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I was looking over all centers in the league. Who provides you with offense, where including three-point shooting, rebounding at an elite level, playmaking at an elite level, and of course the defensive acumen of being, you know, an all-defensive player ultimately? Who banks on all these fields here? Who is basically the complete center? And my conclusion was this: no one. Like, even if you bring up some of the best all-around centers in the league, like, they have that one shortcoming. So if you pick Nikola Jokic, not a great defender necessarily. Like, he's gotten better, but he's not a great all-NBA defender. Mm-hmm. Now, he'll you know, be a good scorer, good rebounder, good playmaker. And, you know, the defense is sort of here and there. Bam, if he gets that three, would have virtually no weakness. That's interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to, like, Embiid, you can say, but he doesn't have the playmaking. Jokic, as you said, doesn't have the defense. Towns doesn't have the defense. Anthony Davis would probably be the closest, but you still wouldn't have given him the playmaking necessarily.
Correct. Yes. And those are the exact players that I actually used in my research.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, you know, will Bam Adebayo ever be a guy who you go in night out expect 25 points per game. I don't know, but I also don't know that you need that out of him given everything else he provides.
I think Bam is ultimately going to be one of those guys who are completely elite at being that second guy, if you catch my drift.
Mm-hmm.
Like that second, that primary big man, because you can basically use him as a swish army knife. There is nothing he can't do, especially if he gets that jumper down.
Yeah, so let's flip to the Miami side now, because, I mean, we kind of already have, but, you know, that's more the look ahead. But, I mean, what, you know, going into game six now, what do you need to adjust if you're Miami? Because, again, you know, first half, you're feeling great. You think this is, like, you know, you're 24 minutes away from closing this team out, and then Boston just kind of barnstorms you in the third quarter. You know, do you think their confidence is shook? Or do you think they just, you know, after the game, of course, they went to the typical, like, they just played harder than us. Do you think it was that simple, or is there some other adjustment that Spo needs to make?
Well, I would like to see them lay off the three unless it's more wide open, because the Miami as a team for this series is shooting just 30.1% from downtown. That is a horrendous, horrendous percentage. And they are rushing some of their three-point shots a bit. I think Jay Crowder in particular has not had it going. He's shooting 26%, but every time he just sees daylight, he's gunning it. And under normal circumstances, I wouldn't have a problem with that. But given that Duncan Robinson, one of the best three-point shooters in the league, is basically an average three-point shooter this series, Jimmy Butler is not hit. You know, Jimmy's at 22%. Tyler Hero is 35%. Goran Dragic, who was shooting phenomenally in the last series, is at 32%. I think you need, you know, to pace yourself a little bit and get the buckets. I think in part, that's why we saw Duncan Robinson go in for more layups and more two-pointers last game. I think this was a concerted effort on Miami as well, saying, okay, so you can take those shots, of course, but we need the sure things as well. So I would look for them to attack the paint a little bit more. And then if that, you know, collapses the defense and that opens up for shooters, then you can start playing that inside-outside brand of basketball.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Heat, just like open up games and just start firing away from the outside when they're shooting 30%, I think that's a problem. You can't rely on the three ball to that extent. I just don't think you can. You need to establish something else and then use the three as a secondary component.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, you know, we spoke with Matt Moore in the last episode, and I brought up Jay Crowder in particular, who had been really good throughout the bubble in terms of three-point percentage, but it was like, you know, he struggled a bit in games two and three in this series, and, you know, it seemed like it was only a matter of time that regression to the mean would hit, and it seems like it finally has, especially in these last two games. He was 1 of 7 from three in game four, 0 of 6 from three in game five. So again, like, those are shots that Boston is willing to live with. And if you can make them pay, that's great. But if you can't, there's a reason they're willing to live with those shots. It's, you know, it's not necessarily the most high percentage play for you. So I'm right with you where, you know, if you look at Miami's team, like, they hit a high volume of threes, but how many elite three-point shooters do they have? It's really Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, Dragic to some extent. But those are the only three guys on their entire team that I feel confident hitting threes. Like, Jimmy? No. Jay Crowder? No. Right. Iguodala? No. Kelly Olynyk? Okay. Really. Yeah, sure. I mean, in the 4 minutes you're going to play every game. But, you know, it's like, on paper, this should not be a good three-point shooting team. And, you know, they have been, to their credit. But, you know, at a certain point, the percentages were probably destined to catch up with them. And it seems like they finally have. So I think you're spot on where they need to, you know, figure out different ways of generating points other than just bombing away from deep.
I would agree. I think for Jimmy in particular, it comes down to just maintaining that level of aggressiveness that we saw early in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he needs to be more than just this 18-point guy. For him, he needs to get into the paint and generate a ton more free throws, floaters, layups, just draw fouls on virtually everyone in his path, because we know he's fully capable of doing that. You know, him sitting at 18.5 points right now is, I think, again, he's trying to do it the right way. He's really pacing himself. He's letting everyone else, like, get their shots in, and he's really trying, I think, to let everyone else get those touches, which is commendable, but now it's not the time. Like, mm-hmm. I know you're up one game, but when you look at the overall stats, I mean, look, the Boston Celtics are out-rebounding Miami by 5 on a per-game basis and outscoring them by almost 3 points per game in the entire series. So Miami just needs that one game where Butler just takes over and he goes, you know what, I'm the first, second, and third option, and every ounce of attention I get, I'll find a way to benefit for myself, and then if I get 3 guys on me, that's when I'll make the pass. I'll make the proper reads, but I'm going to get mine this, you know, tonight. I'm going to get Jason Tatum in foul trouble, and when Jaylen Brown rotates over on me, that's his turn. And when Marcus Smart's on me in the post, that's barbecue chicken for me. I mean, he's got to have one of those 40, 45 points performances, I think.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the free throw drawing in particular. You know, the first 5 games of this series, he has had 6, 6, 6, 9, and 8 in terms of free throw attempts per game. Prior to this series, the first game against Indiana, he had 12. Game 3 against Indiana, he had 20 free throw attempts. Game 1 against Milwaukee, he had 13. Game 3, he had 19. So, I mean, I agree. He needs to make a concerted effort to get into the paint and draw contact, because not only are those more or less, you know, not guaranteed points, but high percentage points that you're going to get at the line, but you're also going to get Boston star players into foul trouble. And if, you know, if Jason Tatum can't play a good chunk of the second quarter because he has two early fouls, then that's only going to put you in better shape. So, yeah, I'm right with you that we need, you know, Jimmy Butler, the high for this series in terms of scoring. He has 24 points in the game 4 win, which they won by 3 points, but otherwise it was 20, 14, 17, and 17. They need more from him.
The 24 should be his average. I mean, let's just be honest. In this series in particular, even though they're up 3-2, that should have been his average. That I need Jimmy to be in that moment that he could be in. If I am the Miami Heat, then I need that guy. I need the $140 million man to step up. And I'm not suggesting that Jimmy isn't stepping up necessarily. I'm saying strictly as a scorer. What he's doing defensively as a playmaker, you know, that he's been phenomenal. And considering, you know, he's averaging 2 turnovers a game despite playing 38 minutes a game. So he's handling the ball, he's protecting the ball, he's getting in, like, he's getting the assists, he's getting the rebounds, he's virtually everywhere. I just want him to dial back all those responsibilities and just go a little be a little bit more singular focused for one game.
Yeah, because I mean, honestly, if Tyler Herro doesn't go absolutely bananas in game 4, they lose that game in a blowout. Like, Boston, despite being down 3-2, probably feels pretty good about where they are. Like, and, you know, we were talking about with this with Matt in the last episode, where it's like, through 3 games, Boston had won a majority of the quarters. It was just like they had these moments where they fell apart, especially in late game situations, and Miami just kind of out-executed them, which you're not used to seeing, you know, from a Brad Stevens coach team, to be out executed in crunch time. But it kind of happened in game 5 too, where, you know, they started off, they were just bombing from 3 and not really generating, you know, those shot attempts were fine. They weren't like terrible, but they weren't the best thing they could have done. And then it seemed like they finally just got more patient and less flustered and got into their offense in that third quarter. And it was like, Miami had no answer for them. So, you know, coming that the momentum, despite Miami being up 3-2, the momentum feels like it's on Boston's side, as nebulous as that sounds. And, you know, I think Jimmy Butler would be the logical counterpunch to that. It's like, okay, you know, Boston feels good going into this game 6. Let's get these dudes in foul trouble. Let's get them out of rhythm. Let's just get me a free throw parade. No, channeling Dwayne Wade in 2006 in the finals. Like, let's, you know, chicanery our way to the finals. Like, let's get that final game. Let's book our trip.
Who do you think stands as a stronger opponent against the Lakers?
That's a really good question. I've been batting it around because, you know, part of me thinks either way the Lakers will be favored whoever moves out of this series. But at the same time, like, the more I think about a Lakers-Miami matchup, it's like Miami has a lot of counters for the Lakers' two best players.
Yeah.
And I don't know that the Lakers have... Oh, I mean, I guess they do. You know, like AD on Bam and LeBron on Jimmy. But then, again, it comes down to, I trust Miami's supporting cast more than I do the Lakers, right?
Oh, for sure. And I trust their transition defense a lot more than I trust Denver's.
Yeah. So who would you pick?
I would pick the Miami Heat as well. But I've been flip-flopping numerous times because on the one hand, you could argue, hey, if you have two wings in the form of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, who are both two-way players and who can get you 20-plus points a game plus great defense, well, that means that together they might be able to shave some efficiency points off of LeBron while at the same time, you know, contribute a great amount offensively. Mm-hmm. And if you nullify that matchup, like if you say Tatum and Brown equals LeBron, okay, then you only need to beat AD, if you catch my drift, and the supporting cast.
Right.
And then that's when you have Kemba. That's when you have Marcus Smart. That's when you have Gordon Hayward. And then you have, you know, Enes Kanter off the bench. You have Daniel Tice in the starting lineup. Is that enough? I don't know. But I think that could be interesting. That said, they don't have that big. And I'm really finding it hilarious that we're sitting here in late 2020 and we're talking about the importance of bigs. But we're talking about Bam Adebayo specifically. If it's the Heat, like putting Bam on AD and basically telling him, you know, it doesn't matter if you score a single point in this series, you just need to put the clamps on AD and, you know, give us 15 rebounds and great individual defense on AD. And if you cancel that out, that one-to-one matchup, then Miami has so many options they can throw at LeBron.
Right.
They can rotate Jimmy onto him, Iggy, Jay Crowder. I mean, even if they decide to play Kendrick Nunn a little bit, maybe even him on occasion, like there's just so many opportunities there. And then you have the free roamers like Tyler Hero and Duncan Robinson who can splash to death, whereas I don't trust Danny Green to be able to hit at a consistent level. So I'm leaning Miami, but I'm not necessarily out on the Celtics' chances against the Lakers.
No, I'm with you. I mean, we're at 3-1 and 3-2 in the conference finals, and I still cannot with any confidence tell you who is going to win the NBA title this year, which I think is, you know, it's fun compared to where we've been in the last 4 or 5 years. Like, this feels like you could, even Denver, who we'll get to shortly, like, you could still make a case just because they overcame 3-1 twice. Like, okay, yeah, I could see it happening again. And then, you know, a Denver-Miami finals, like, Jokic could just run wild. I don't know. But I'm with you that the Bam-AD matchup in particular, it feels like Bam is one of the only bigs really in the NBA that could be a good one-on-one matchup for him that can actually, you know, really harass him defensively and stick with him regardless of whether he's in the paint, on the perimeter, operating in pick and rolls, who cares? Like, Bam can do all of that. And then you're totally right. You know, Miami has a number of wings they can throw at LeBron. Also, like, Lord knows Andre Iguodala over the last 5 years has gained some institutional knowledge about going against LeBron in the NBA Finals. You know, I mean, this is what, talk about having a good locker room guy to instill knowledge to your younger players. Who better than the guy who ended up guarding LeBron for a good chunk of those minutes in those four finals meetings? You know, that
and Jimmy too. Jimmy's guarded LeBron in playoff context as well on several occasions. I think Jay Crowder matched up with LeBron in the playoffs as well at some point, didn't he?
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. Right when he was with Boston, you mean?
Yeah, I think so. But maybe I'm misremembering. Maybe those two haven't met in the playoffs.
Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head either way.
No, maybe not. But at least you're right. Iggy has definitely, you know, a very intimate understanding of how LeBron plays Jimmy has played against LeBron for years and years and years. So those two would definitely spearhead the informational superhighway for the Heat. Like, hey, maybe don't do this. Maybe do this and this and that instead.
Right.
And one thing I would just change up with Davis and James, regardless if I'm Boston or if I'm Miami, I would just let them shoot from the outside. I understand LeBron could get hot. I'm not saying that he couldn't, you know, have a game where he just beats you from three. But and Matt Moore actually said this as well when he was on earlier this week, and I completely agree with him on this. I don't trust, you know, AD's jumper, you know, long range jump shot at least. I don't trust his three at all. So if he falls in love with that and settles for, you know, long shots, by all means, go ahead.
Right. I mean, you could argue that Boston should feel the same way about Jimmy Butler. You know, there was the late game possession in game four where they trapped him on a pick and roll. It's like, you guys seen what Jimmy Butler is shooting on three this year? That's the absolute last defensive strategy you should try, because then he's going to pass to Bam, who is a great playmaker. You're going to have a 4-on-3 opportunity, and we saw what happened. I mean, it was an easy bucket. It effectively closed the game. So, I mean, there is still a ways to go before we could really hypothesize an exact Heat Lakers finals matchup, and whenever these series are decided, we will do a full finals preview. But I'm glad you asked that question, because it is a fun thought experiment of like which of these two teams would be the better matchup for the Lakers. And I mean, I think you could ask 100 different people and you get a number of different answers.
Yeah, I think so too, which I agree, it's certainly unpredictable, and that just gives it another layer of enjoyment.
Yeah. So let's go into the other side of the bracket. The Denver Nuggets have the Lakers right where they want them. They're down 3-1. I mean, again, this could have been easily a 2-2 series if AD doesn't hit that shot at the end of game two. So this is, you know, like game one was a blowout. The Lakers routed the Nuggets, and that was not close. But these last three games have been pretty close either way. I mean, they, you know, it could have easily been 3-1 Nuggets instead of 3-1 Lakers. So from the Nuggets' perspective, Mort, what do you think they need to do to steal Game 5 tonight?
Transition defense. Because they are not picking up LeBron when he gets the ball. I know they don't have a lot of players on their roster who can really pick him up and group. You know, they don't have one of the Miami guys whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But as soon as the Lakers jump out and they run off, even off of makes and especially off of defensive rebounds, Denver just sort of stands a little bit flat-footed. They're not as agile. They're not as reactive. And that's a problem, because if you allow LeBron James and Anthony Davis to get layups, those are free points, because both are just great around the basket. You need to somehow, and not, you know, I'm quoting Stan Van Gundy here, you need to form a effing wall around them on some level, around the basket at least, and force them into jump shots. That recipe sounds awfully simplistic, but nevertheless, it's true. You need to turn them into jump shooters instead of slashers and drivers, mm-hmm. because otherwise they're just going to run you dry all night long.
Yeah, which is what we saw in Game 3 when they had that, you know, the massive 20-point lead in the fourth quarter, and then they started turning the ball over. The Lakers just absolutely wrecked them in transition for about 6 minutes before they finally stymied the bleeding just in time.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's certainly one recipe to not get blown out in Game 5. I mean, number two, don't get Nikola Jokic in foul trouble, and, you know,
that would be good.
Right. I don't know how you can necessarily strategize for that, but that clearly affected him in game four. The one adjustment, or I guess there are two adjustments we should talk about that we saw in game four. One was, you know, late in the game, Jamal Murray was sensational yet again. And then LeBron James switched on to him late in game four. And it did, yeah, I don't want to say totally stifle him, but he was not nearly as effective with LeBron on him as he had been prior to that. So I think, you know,
understandably so.
Yeah, right. Of course. So, you know, if game five is close tonight late in the fourth quarter, I think the Nuggets should expect LeBron to do the same thing again. What's the counterpunch to that?
Right. Yeah. Nikola Jokic, I think. I mean, Jokic was way too passive last game. It was one of those situations where he kind of reverted back to being, you know, I don't know how to explain this, but I'm just going to say he reverted into being an 82-game player instead of a 16-game player, because he was just not, he didn't have the rhythm, he didn't really have the shot, he was sort of under the radar, and you felt constantly that he was leaving effort on the table. I think Jokic is the counter. If someone adjusts to Jamal Murray, okay. Then you have to adjust if you're the Nuggets and go into a two-man game of Nikola Jokic and Michael Porter with Jeremy Grant as some sort of, you know, lob threat decoy or whatever. You just need to do something else, at least. And for Jokic, that means being that superstar that he's looked at. I don't remember what he finished with last game. Was it like 16 or 18? Or
yeah,
it wasn't high.
16 on 6 of 13 shooting, 7 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 steals, 2 threes.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's objectively a good game if you're, like, for anyone. That's not, statistically, it's fine, but this is the playoffs. It's one of the most important games of the season. You know, 13 shot attempts or 14 shot attempts or whatever, that should have been 25.
Right.
Nikola Jokic is a good scorer. I know that's not necessarily his mentality, but he can do it, and he can do so efficiently. So I think for the Nuggets, this is a matter of establishing him. This is a matter of also telling him, hey, you know what? You need to get your ass moving. I even think during halftime that Mike Malone was like, yeah, you know, that was the message. Like, Jokic has to be more aggressive. We need that to happen. Otherwise, we're not going to win. And lo and behold, that happened. So if Jamal Murray's game is taken away of sorts, the counter has to be Jokic.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. You know, he is that traditional, it's like Steve Nash back with the Mike D'Antoni Suns, where he's such a traditional playmaker that he doesn't always look for his own offense. Like, he prefers getting his right. teammates going. But, you know, he does have those games where he does hunt for his own shot a little bit more. And you see it especially on the threes, I think, where, you know, someone will kick it to him on the perimeter. He's wide open and, like, sometimes there was just a little bit of hesitation there. He's like, I could take this shot, and I feel confident about it, but I want to create a better shot for my teammates. But at the same time, like, he's a good three-point shooter. Like, he needs to take that shot, and he needs to have the confidence when he catches that ball. Like, just be decisive, because I think that's, you know, a big part of knocking down those shots is, like, just knowing right away, I'm catching it, I'm rising up, I'm shooting, I'm going to focus on my mechanics when I go up, and I'm going to envision that shot going in, rather than like, I'm going to take this shot, but I don't feel great about it. Because, you know, more often than not, right, it's probably not going to go in at that point. You know, we saw it in the Clippers series. In game 6, he had 34 points, 14 rebounds, 7 assists, 22 field goal attempts. Like, he was actively hunting his shot at that point. And we even saw it in game 2 of this Lakers series. He had 30 points on 9 of 20 shooting. So he has gotten it going at times as a scorer, even in this series. But I'm right with you there. Like, I don't think, as much as we both love Michael Porter Jr. and love his potential and love what he could become, I don't think in a, you know, winner-go-home situation, the Nuggets are going to feel comfortable saying, all right, you know, LeBron's on Jamal Murray, we're going to put our season on the line with Michael Porter Jr. Like, they need to go through their best player.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they might be forced to use Michael Porter Jr. a lot, especially if LeBron has Jamal Murray on lockdown, because then you have to establish two-man games of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, though, just to wrap up my thoughts as well, is when I look at the rebounding of this series, I get puzzled. Because you have Jeremy Grant, who's an athletic 6'9", you know, power forward center, just a big. He's played 138 minutes this series, and he's grabbed 9 boards. He's averaging 2.3 rebounds per game in this series in just under 35 minutes per game. That just needs to be better as well. So it's not just going through the big guys, the big stars. It's also during the course of the game, using that size advantage that you have to just get multiple possessions back. Like, close out a defensive possession by getting the defensive rebound. Get an additional offensive possession by getting the offensive rebound. Like, right now, the Nuggets are out-rebounding the Lakers by 0.3 per game. That should be by far more than that when you consider that it's basically Davis, LeBron, and Dwight Howard who are the rebounders, and you're not going to get rebounding from Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. You're not getting rebounding from Kyle Kuzma. Rondo is not a great rebounder anymore. He was in his heyday. Danny Green is not a rebounder. Like, Alex Caruso is not a rebounder. Markieff Morris is a three-point shooter. JaVale McGee barely plays. You know, there are more components to it as well. For Denver, I think at the end of the close game, that's when you go Jokic. But they have so many more adjustments to make during the flow of the whole game. Like, get better on the glass. Make smarter decisions. And side note, the Lakers are actually averaging more assists per game as well. And you can see that when they start to run, they share the ball. It's like quick passes out to the corners. These are the Nuggets. We always talk about them as being one of the best passing teams in the NBA. And they are, but they haven't really shown it. So I think for them, it comes down to stringing together a full game before we even start to get into the clutch arguments about who should have the ball.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up Dwight Howard, because that's the other big adjustment that we need to talk about from game four is JaVale McGee went to the bench and only played 5 minutes in the series. Dwight Howard came out 12 points, 11 rebounds. Most of that was in the first half. And that was a marked departure from game three when the Lakers bigs combined for, I believe, 4 rebounds in total on the night. I mean, it's very clear that Frank Vogel, after game three, you know, that was a game where they got out rebounded. I believe it was 44-25. So I'm going to guess film session after game three was, hey, dudes, go get a rebound. And Dwight Howard, that message sank in very quickly. What adjustments do the Nuggets have to make? You know, clearly, I think it's fair to assume that Dwight Howard is going to stay in the starting lineup in game five. Yeah. How do you counteract his dominance on the boards?
You fight. So on numerous occasions, especially in the first half, you know, Jokic was a bystander. Dwight was his direct matchup. And yet when Dwight was going up for offensive rebounds, Jokic at least one point didn't even, you know, his feet didn't even leave the ground. He was flat-footed looking at what was going on. So for Denver, I just need the commitment. I need to see them fight for the rebounds a little bit more. You cannot just win solely off of talent. And if the Lakers are saying, you know what, we're actively going after offensive rebounding just to maximize our number of possessions, yeah, then the Nuggets can believe all they want that offensive rebounding is a dead thing in the NBA. Well, sure, but if they lose a game because of it, they need to adjust. They need to make sure that those boards are get taken down. So it becomes a matter of, I think, on some level, personal pride in their defense. You know, wrap up those defensive possessions. That's the one thing they can't do. Like, you know, they don't have that one player on the roster that they haven't used who they can suddenly insert.
Right.
Much like the Lakers have with Howard, who's going to come in and give you, you know, 12 rebounds per game.
No Mason Plumlee moving into the starting lineup, you mean?
Oh, God, no, no. Less Plumlee, more PJ Dozier, if anything.
Yeah. No, I think
so wait, but I have a question for you though.
Yeah.
And this is a little bit more perimeter oriented. Gary Harris. So full disclosure, you and I we've been Gary Harris fans on this podcast. We've been really saddened to see that over the past 2 years he's been constantly injured.
Yeah.
We like Gary Harris is my point.
Yes.
Because we also hear great things about him from our friend of the podcast, TJ McBride. You know, just how he is as a human being behind closed doors. So it breaks my heart just asking you this, but is it time to remove him from the starting lineup?
Because of what the little bit that he's providing offensively, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, defensively, I think he's been... Well, I don't think he's been up to standard of what a normal Gary Harris, you know, usually is, but right. I do think he's been good.
Yeah.
But offensively, he's 6 of 23 over the course of 4 games. So granted, he's not shooting much, which does mean that he's not hurting you as much as if he was shooting high volume. But he's shooting 26% from the field. Whenever he gets those looks, it, you know, I don't know about you, but when I watch him play right now and he gets open looks and he shoots, there is zero confidence level in me, at least, that that shot is going down.
Right.
And I wonder if that's the same for his teammates, because that has this ripple down effect. You know, if a guy, right, doesn't trust his jump shot, and his teammates doesn't trust that player's jump shot either, that becomes sort of the thing that can spread around a little bit. Is it time to either remove him from the starting lineup or make a concerted effort in actually getting him going in the first quarter tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question back to you would be, if you do remove him from the starting lineup, who are you putting in his place? Because if it's Monte Morris, I think you need his playmaking off the bench. I mean, he's been very good in these last two games in particular. You know, if it's Michael Porter, the Lakers are actively targeting him on defense, and he was, you know, pretty bad on that end of the floor in game four in particular.
Right.
I guess you could argue Torrey Craig, because, you know, but at that point, is he going to give you much more offensively than Gary Harris is? Like, he's going to fill a similar role, I agree. But right. Then, you know, that's going to put Gary Harris off the bench, where he might need to produce more offensively in kind of that six-man role. And I don't necessarily know that you want that, because, as you said, he's not doing much damage to you since he's been pretty low volume. You know, I think the fact that Jeremy Grant has gotten more aggressive these last few games in particular somewhat mitigates the damage that Harris is doing offensively. Like,
agreed.
You know, I think it would be more of an issue if your only two real scoring threats in that starting lineup were Murray and Jokic, because that's going to make you so predictable. But Jeremy Grant has been more aggressive hunting his own shot in this series, which is great. So would I have a quick leash on Gary Harris? Probably. But I just don't know that any of the alternatives are better than what he provides, if that makes sense.
Right. Ultimately, I think you're right. But at the same time, I'm looking at a starting lineup with two players, which is 40% of this entire starting unit, who right now you may not be able to trust offensively.
Him and Millsap, you mean?
Because Paul Millsap is shooting 31.8% from the field in 24 minutes per game. I don't know if this is, again, where I come back to this whole offensive versus defense thing. Like, that it's always the go-to, both from coaches and fans, like, oh, that player doesn't give you defense. Well, you know, the name of the game at the end of the day is still, you know, who has the most points. Like, I do think that sometimes we have a tendency as an NBA community to just say, well, if you just play defense, the points are automatically going to come, which is a load of crap. That is just a load of crap and a very wrongful way of looking at basketball. You need to have players who can consistently create both for themselves and for others to get points on the board. And right now, you have two good defenders in Paul Millsap and Gary Harris, but they're not otherworldly defenders. So to me, that makes it a little bit harder to justify their continued presence for a combined 50 minutes per game. Mm-hmm. You know, if Paul Millsap and Gary Harris were, like, you know, prime Andre Roberson and before the injury, and I don't know, a 6'8" Marcus Smart, fine. That, you know, that's a game changer. That's a different perspective, because then you have terrific, otherworldly, all NBA caliber defense right there. But you don't. They're not that good. I mean, Paul Millsap is really slow-footed, and when he's matched up against Anthony Davis, it's cookies.
Right.
It's not really that. I mean, that's probably going too far. It's not cookies, but, you know, Davis does have a certain advantage over Millsap just in length, explosiveness, athleticism, touch. It's not a fair fight, is my point.
Right.
So at the end of the day, you got to weigh it out. And I think it might be time to, if not Gary Harris, maybe you just replace Paul Millsap in the starting lineup with Michael Porter. I don't know. I do think defense is important, but you also need to just score the ball at a higher level. And when 40% of your starting lineup is not reliable offensively, you have a problem, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the whole theory with defense versus offense, and you need to be able to, you know, I mean, hell, even Mike Malone came out after game four and said, if you can't play defense, maybe you shouldn't be in our lineup. And it was pretty clearly targeted to Michael Porter Jr., which is not a great sign for his likelihood of starting game five, I would say. But, you know, I think the whole theory is because, again, a guy like Michael Porter Jr. is a dynamic three-level scorer, but he has been so bad defensively at times in these playoffs that every time he's on the floor, they go after him every single possession. And is he giving you enough offensively to counteract what he gives up defensively? And that's why coaches, especially with role players in the starting lineup, right, tend to prefer, okay, this guy's not a great offensive threat, but at least he gives us something defensively. But to your point, you know, even the best defender is not going to stop an elite scorer 100% of the time. Like, even when Millsap goes up against Anthony Davis, Anthony Davis is going to score on him at times. Can Millsap counteract that with, he doesn't need to score 20 points per game, that no one's expecting that out of him, but can he give you 8, 10? Like, that's what you need out of him, right? You know, hopefully, instead of, you know, he's averaging, as you said, 5.5 points per game on 31.8% shooting. Like, that, you know, is he basically the complete 180 inverse of Michael Porter Jr., where he's doing good work defensively, but he's doing more damage to you offensively? Like, he's not offsetting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm, this is what I'm attacking. Right. Yeah. Exactly. You got it.
And I mean, I think it's just really tricky for the Nuggets because I don't know that they have another guy. You know, you can name anyone else who you might want to sub out with one of those guys, but it's like they're going to present their own set of problems. So I don't know that there's really a great answer, unfortunately, for them.
This is where they miss Will Barton.
Yeah. Oh, badly.
Yeah. And this is also why, because we've had this conversation so many times before about, you know, offensive players who can't produce defensively and vice versa. But this is why moving forward that getting two-way wings or two-way players in general is of such vital importance. Like, nowadays, you can barely draft a guy, even if it's like in the late first round, if he's just a one-way player, there are going to be moments when you can't have him on the floor.
Right.
So I think the entire perspective of player evaluation has to change. I think that great teams have correctly identified that, you know what, we'll be drafting this transcendent offensive talent, which is great, but that's not going to help us in the playoffs. Like, look, I brought him up earlier as a potential LeBron defender. That was only physicality-wise. But look at Kendrick Nunn. He's played 23 minutes in this series. And he was averaging, what, like almost 14, 15? Let me just look him up. In the regular season, mm-hmm. he was you know, he was playing almost 30 minutes a night. He was starting every single game and averaging 15 points per game, rather.
Yeah.
And now you're like, no, we can't even use you because, what, conditioning, defense, something like that. Whereas sometimes I think you just got to play the best players that you have if you know, those are the cards that you're dealt. But why even put yourself in that position if you draft a guy or sign a guy or whatever who might only give you something on one end of the court? Then why not make a larger effort like the Raptors are doing and going out and like finding a guy like Chris Boucher, for example, who's like, oh, he's playing two-way basketball. He mm-hmm. might not be a 20-point scorer. He might not be an all-NBA defender, but he can give you enough on both ends of the court that he's not a liability anywhere. Like, that, I think, should be the next way we gauge players.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the playoffs and really these conference finals in particular are going to have some really interesting implications for the draft, where there isn't necessarily, you know, this Zion type, like, clear-cut number one pick, and there isn't a Ja where it's like these two guys are so far ahead of the pack, where it's a more of like a beauty in the eye of the beholder type of class. Well, I'm sure.
Are you plucking the article that I literally wrote today for Forbes?
Unintentionally, yes. But we'll get into this in a later date when we have nothing to do but talk about the draft for a month. But, you know, I do wonder if it's like guys like Denny or Devin Vassell end up jumping up boards because teams are like, we just need someone who can be playable on both ends. Whereas, you know, James Wiseman, who elite offensive potential, we're not 100% sure about what he can provide defensively and if he can stay on the court in a conference finals type of matchup. Like, does he slip down boards a little bit more?
Right.
And, you know, it's just an interesting thought to keep parked in the back of your brain as you're watching the rest of the conference finals and the finals. It's like, what archetype of player is most valuable in today's NBA? And, you know, when you're evaluating in the draft, especially high up in the board, it's, you know, typically best player available versus, you know, fit and need. You know, is like talent wise, if you had to put an NBA 2K rating on this player, maybe he is more talented than someone else, but should you prefer his skill set over someone else's or his archetype over someone else's? It's going to raise some really interesting questions for this draft.
Well, I mean, you basically just kind of read my article right there. So for those who are interested in that, go in and read my latest on Forbes called Swing Big or Draft Safely, What Should Teams Do at the 2020 NBA Draft.
There we go. Good plug. Good plug.
Plug, plug, plug.
So, Mort, let's wrap up with the Sixers, who have been in the news this week. Their coaching search is still ongoing, but now that Billy Donovan is with the Bulls, it seems like they're basically between Mike D'Antoni and Ty Lue. And there was a reporter, John Clark, I believe he is NBC Sports Philadelphia, reported Thursday, I think it was, that part of their reported interest in Mike D'Antoni is the hope that he could also one day lure James Harden to the organization. So when I saw this, I tweeted that the Sixers are basically the Knicks with better branding now. And I and let me tell you, that got a lot of likes, but then there were also like a handful of Sixers fans that were like, but wait, the Sixers had won more games and have more stars. And I'm like, you guys are missing the point entirely. Like, it is just so Knicks-ish to be like, we're going to hire a coach to lure a free agent in 2 years, even though we currently kind of suck and we'll have no cap space at that point. Like, wait, yeah. This is just the absolute most asinine. I can only hope it isn't true, but given the way they've operated the team over the last 4 years, I'm pretty sure it actually is. But it's, like, inexplicably dumb, if that's really part of their rationale.
So I just looked up that tweet of yours. This is the second time in a week that you've gone semi-viral.
Just by crapping on the Sixers? Yes, that is correct.
Yes, I think it is. And at no point have you said, hey, check out my SoundCloud.
I know. Very disappointed. I'm saving
this
it.
This was a great promotional opportunity for this podcast, and you completely screwed the pooch, Brian.
I know. I need to make a SoundCloud, and then the first like 10,000 likes tweet that I get, that's when I drop the link. It'll just be Vin Diesel's latest pod or latest song instead. Oh, God. Yeah. But I mean, like,
well,
tell me I'm wrong here in thinking that this is just like so absolutely outrageously dumb that you almost have to hope it's not true.
Of course. Of course. And look, so even if we take it a step further and let's say it actually happens, right?
Right.
So it would probably be a couple of years away. James Harden would be 33 at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Mike D'Antoni, who's at that point 72 and you know, might be considering at that point hanging it up, I could imagine. Because, you know, in today's world, we don't even know if we're going to wake up tomorrow. Because this is where we are in society.
Right.
Okay, so 2 years ahead, somehow, some way, you know, the Sixers trade for a 33-year-old James Harden, who by then has played over 32,000 career minutes in the regular season. Let me just scroll down to the playoffs here, because that's probably an additional, about 5,500 minutes, plus All-Star, plus training camps. What's the ceiling on that? Like, what are the Sixers trying to accomplish there? Like, what is that end goal? What does that look like?
Well, they saw how well the 33-year-old Al Horford played for them this year, and they're like, let's go right back to that well.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make a lick of sense. And if that's the merits of, or that's the reasoning why you would hire Mike D'Antoni, just don't. But right. But okay, I might be the wrong person to ask because I am so out on the Sixers as an organization, on their roster, on virtually everything, that I'm just like, hey, blow it all up, sell the team, new management, completely new coaching staff, you know, rebuild from the bottom up. And if you rehire Sam Hinkie, fine. That's one way I would absolutely love it. But I'm so out on that organization right now. I don't foresee any way they can bandage this together to ultimately make it a competitive championship contender.
Outside of trading Ben and Joe, you're basically a Sixers fan at this point. Like, most people are at the sell the team, completely overhaul the front office, which they're not going to do based on all reports. It sounds like they're going to hire people under Elton Brand, but Elton Brand is going to stay in charge of the basketball operations. They're going to hire a coach at some point. But I mean, like, let's quickly walk through. So to get to 2022, they're still going to have all four of their big contracts on the books unless they somehow trade Horford, Tobias, Ben, Joe. They would have to trade at least two of those guys to be able to afford Harden. And even at that point, depending on what the NBA finances situation is like, it still might not be possible. Like, you might have to trade three of those four guys just to be able to sign Harden in free agency, which, okay, at that point, what are you left with? I mean, it's asinine. And then so the other idea would be, you know, trading for him. I know people on Rockets Twitter have been batting around the idea because they are also kind of in the same existential crisis mode where it's like, I think they feel about the Russ trade as Sixers fans feel about the Tobias and Al signings, where it's like, this might have been such an egregious F up that we can't overcome it. And the only way out is to just trade our best player and start to tinker around the margins. You know, they're talking about a Simmons plus something picks, whatever, Thibault for Harden trade. And I don't see why the Rockets would do that other than fear that James Harden's going to leave in 2 years that we talked about a week or two ago when we gave them the buy Felicia. And I, you know, from the Sixers perspective, it's like, sure, Harden and Embiid make sense on paper. I guess this is a slightly better fitting roster, although then you have no wing depth whatsoever, and Jason Tatum's just going to score 50 on you when you run into him in the playoffs. But it's just, like, I can't emphasize enough how much it's a Knicks plan at this point. That's, I don't say that sarcastically. It is, we are going to lure the star free agent, even though we have no long-term plan right now, and we are making no moves toward establishing a long-term plan other than we have a lot of talent that we cobbled together like it was an NBA 2K roster, even though it doesn't fit at all. We are stuck with a lot of these guys because who in their right mind is going to want them? It's all just so messed up. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's a little bit different from the Knicks in the sense that the Sixers actually do have certain stars on the roster right now.
Right.
Whereas the Knicks just, you know, they just need that one star. Then maybe they can get something off the ground and then they'll run it into the ground a year later. I don't know.
Right.
You know, at least the Sixers have two stars. They just don't fit well together. And that's when you kind of need to figure out, okay, how can we pivot from that? The thing is, though, regardless of how you flip it, you know, and we've talked about this, and I know you disagree with me on this, and that's completely fine, but the way I see it is you cannot have, you know, the type of player that Joel Embiid is as the best player on the team. You cannot, in 2020, run an entire offense around a center. You just can't. And then if you go the other direction and you trade Joel Embiid and then keep Ben Simmons around, then Simmons can't be the number one guy on a championship team.
Mm-hmm.
He's just not offensively inclined enough to do that. He is way more of a secondary, maybe even tertiary guy, at least offensively speaking. Defensively, he's phenomenal, and that's great. But that could boil down to what we were talking about earlier in terms of how do you look at players who are more dominant on one end of the court than the other, where you ask yourself, what can Ben do offensively to kind of justify him, you know, being a vital player?
Right.
Because he's not going to give you the shooting, I don't think. I don't think that three-pointer is coming. I'm going to be honest with you. I just don't think it's coming. He's probably not going to be an 80% guy at the line either. So he's going to be, what, 10 feet and in predominantly, I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then we run into sort of the same issue as Embiid as well. That, oh, the offense has to basically start from within 10 feet and then move out. And then, there's this whole idea. Well, if you flank Ben Simmons with shooters, well, okay. So a much better player than him in Giannis Antetokounmpo went that route, and that didn't work. So I just don't know what the end result is going to... Well, I do know. It's not going to be a championship.
Mm-hmm.
So I think ultimately it's... You should trade both and start over. But again, we've been over this. To me, it should just be one big explosion and everything should change.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is, you know, I've heard that, that kind of like plan is just flank these guys with a bunch of 3-and-D players and shooters. And it's like, they're so easy to find. It's like, they're not easy to find. Every single team is going after this type of player. And the Sixers are, I mean, they're already going to be $17 million over the luxury tax line next year. They're going to only have their taxpayer mid-level exception. They have 5 draft picks, at least 3 of which they're bound to sell. And then they're going to have nothing but veteran minimum contracts. And, you know, cap space is going to be tight around the league. So I'm not saying that like a lot of guys are going to cash in necessarily, but you know, a type of Alec Burks player who gave them a significant boost just by being a guard who can dribble and create a shot on his own occasionally, like that type of player will probably cost the taxpayer mid-level this offseason. And so they'll get one of them and then they'll be forced to rely on the Raul Netos of the world who, you know, fell out of the rotation pretty quickly. So I, as much as it's fun to think about, oh, okay, like we can trade Al Horford for Buddy Hield, and, you know, why wouldn't the Kings say yes to that? I do think it's going to be a lot harder to remake this roster than a lot of Sixers fans think right now. I have a piece coming out. FanSided is doing a thing. I think it's going to come out either next week or the week after. But it's like envisioning the NBA in 2030. So,
oh
yeah. So I wrote something about the Sixers where they're just trapped on the treadmill of mediocrity for the entire 2020s. They have won no more than 44 games and no fewer than 38. And I chronologically explain how each misstep goes along the way. And it was like, they trade Harden for, or they trade Embiid and a couple unprotected picks for Harden. Harden forgets how to shoot. He leaves in free agency. Ben Simmons demands out. Like, it was among the worst case scenarios, but you could very plausibly see all of these things happening. So, yeah, I mean, I'm honestly with you. Like, I don't think they're going to trade one of Ben or Joe this offseason. Elton Brand says they're not going to. I will take him at his word. I think they're going to try to bring in a new coach, whether it's D'Antoni or Ty Lue, and try to figure out how to make this thing work. And maybe they'll be able to trade Horford or Tobias Harris and find a better fitting piece on a similarly bad contract. But I do kind of think the ultimate conclusion is next offseason. It would not surprise me if Joel Embiid either demands a trade publicly or just does it privately and, you know, kind of tells them that if they don't make a move soon, he's going to demand publicly, yeah. And then they're going to lose a lot of leverage. But like I'm becoming more acquainted to the idea that this is we're heading into Joel Embiid's last year as a Sixer. And I don't think it's, you know, can you build a championship team around Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid? I think you can. I mean, I think they weren't far off last year with Butler, but I think they screwed up so much over the past few years that I don't think there's a way out of it now.
So I would just argue that you don't build a championship contender around Simmons and Embiid when you have Jimmy Butler. You build a championship team around Jimmy Butler, as we're seeing in Miami right now.
That's fair.
I mean, because it's more along the lines of just what kind of options they are and also what levels they give you. Like, Joel Embiid should not be shooting as much from outside as he should, which is, again, you know, it's funny when I say that compared to when I just said you can't have an offense about around a guy who is primarily inside dominant. But you can have that if you have that second guy who can create jump shots for yourself or for himself, mm-hmm. and who can hit threes. Maybe that's not Jimmy, of course, but you need to have that dominant wing. Like a guy like Jason Tatum, that would be the perfect player to put alongside Joel Embiid.
Right. Yeah, I mean, right. Embiid has repeatedly expressed his frustration, even throughout the playoffs, about Jimmy Butler not being on this team, because he said, you know, Jimmy Butler is a guy that I could trust in late game situations with the ball. And the Sixers just don't have that guy. And that was one of the questions about them coming into the season was, okay, you know, we saw that Toronto series. It was Jimmy Butler running the offense in the fourth quarter. Who's going to be that guy? And they, you know, they deflected and said, well, we're going to, you know, we're not going to have the one guy. We're going to run it through a bunch of different guys. It could be Tobias one night, Ben one night, Joe one night, Josh Richardson one night, and it proved to be none of them. So, I mean, I'm with you in thinking, like, they need that star wing. And, you know, that goes back to the whole idea about the draft, too, moving forward, is, like, I think you're going to look for those type of two-way wings and, you know, a guy like a Tyler Hero where you know he has that potential as a high level scorer, and can you coach him up in the other areas? You know, I was watching something with, I think it was Duncan Robinson and Jeff Goodman of Stadium, and he was talking about, you know, when he met with a bunch of teams, they were like, okay, you're an elite shooter, but how can we get you, you know, how can we like coach you up defensively to get you on the floor? And Miami apparently was like, all right, you're an elite shooter. We're going to make you even better as a shooter. Like, we want to focus even more effort on improving that aspect of your game. So you are so valuable there that if you are conceding points defensively, it's okay because three is more than two. So,
right,
you know, it moving forward, especially for a team like the Sixers who are hopelessly capped out, like, the draft is going to be one of their only options of actually bringing in guys who can make a difference. But yeah, I mean, it's these playoffs and these conference finals in particular raise some really interesting questions about team building moving forward, both for a team like the Sixers, but really just anyone. I mean, you know, you kind of have to reevaluate, do we have this type of player who can take the leap that Jamal Murray is in these playoffs? And if not, you know, do we have a championship contender on our hands, or are we just like BSing ourselves? And even if we can win 50 games in the regular season, can we win a high level playoff series?
Yeah. Well, on the bright side, you're not the Kings who decided that Luke Walton is going to get another shot.
That's, and the Kings who passed up a chance of drafting Luka Doncic.
Oh. And I mean, look, with a new GM and you make the decision to not fire Luke Walton.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
That's not great. Not a good story.
Not, definitely not. I can't wait for Al Horford to wear a Kings uniform next year. Well, on that note, we can wrap up. We hope you guys are enjoying the conference finals. We will be back. I mean, it seems like these should wrap up in the next few days, so we should have a finals preview ready to go and hopefully sometime early next week. In the meantime, please stay safe. Follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. on iTunes. Please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. I'm Brian Toporek, and as always, I was joined by Morten Jensen. Mort, any movie/TV reviews before we go?
Yes. So Enola Holmes on Netflix, Millie Bobby Brown, Henry Cavill, Helena Bonham Carter. It's a great little adventure crime family movie. I'm not going to go into the whole plot because that's something you just need to experience. But I'm still amazed at Millie Bobby Brown, who obviously plays 11 in Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. You know, 16 years old, and she is acting her ass off as if she's been in the game for 20 years. She's just amazing. Henry Cavill plays Sherlock. It's just a fun time. So if you got a kid, you got a couple kids in the 10 to 12 age group or older, sit down the entire family and turn on Netflix. It's really good.
I actually hate people like Millie Bobby Brown because it makes me mad for a 16-year-old to already be more accomplished than we will ever be. It's like, share some of that, please. But
well, I mean, yeah. I don't disagree with that. I always get jealous whenever I see the youngsters coming. Even with NBA players, I remember being so pissed at Andres Bjelland because he was the first player who came into the NBA who was younger than me. So I was like, when he came into the NBA, I was like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
And I was he was drafted at 18. And I was 18 at the time. I was like, okay, that cements it for me. I'm not going to be that successful.
Right. My peak has already passed. All right, good to know.
Yep.
Yeah. Well,
so yeah, if you want to feel very, very depressed about what you've accomplished in your life, go watch Enola Holmes.
Well, I finished High Fidelity on Hulu. Strong recommend, especially anyone who ever watched the movie. There are a lot of fun callbacks to it, but it also branches out in just a fantastic way. We've also started watching this show that no one's ever heard of before. It's called Schitt's Creek. Has won no awards whatsoever, but no, it won like every Emmy last week. But it is fantastic, and you know, it took a little bit to get into that. The first few episodes, especially, where you know it is so critically acclaimed now, and like so many people recommend it to us, and we're like, this isn't that good. But as the show progresses, you really get to fall in love with the characters in a shocking way. So. Strong recommend to anyone who was also very late to the game like we were. Check it out. It is on Netflix.
Is it a sitcom or like a comedy like New Girl?
So it's kind of like a dark comedy, I would describe it. So it's not, you know, because we watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine right before that, and that's more of like a, you know, pithy one-liners back and forth, and New Girl's the same way.
Right.
So this is more like... there are some funny one-liners, but it's also more just like situational comedy where, I mean, the whole plot is like a very rich family has to go to this podunk town and live in a motel. And it's just like how they adapt to their new lifestyle. So at first they're all kind of deplorable, but then as they kind of grow to accept their new surroundings, they become much more lovable.
Interesting. I have heard about it, but I have not really necessarily put it as a priority, but maybe I should have.
Yeah, it's very entertaining. Eugene Levy's fantastic, and his son, Dan Levy, plays his son in the show as well, and it has been critically acclaimed for his role in particular, and I won't give away any spoilers there, but yeah, would definitely recommend it. We are in season 4 of 6 now, and yeah, I think especially after, I think really like the end of season 2, it really hit its stride and has been fantastic ever since.
I'm sold.
Yeah, we got a long off season ahead, guys. We're gonna give you a lot more recommendations because Lord knows we're gonna have time.
Oh yeah, and look, this is I've heard so many people say, you know, we're running wrong on this, but you know, who cares? You can turn it off now if you don't want to hear about TV or movies. That's all good, but. So basically I hear a lot about, you know, how there are too many shows. Mm. There's too much content almost. Well, it's almost like it was just perfectly built for this pandemic that we were going to, and because now I'm like, yeah, I kind of need all that content. That's great.
Right.
So whenever someone suggests a new show, I'm like, that's probably awesome actually, because this is going to take a while.
Yeah, when there are no NBA games until March, you will be grateful that there are so many streaming options.
Oh my God, NBA Twitter is going to be TV show Twitter, and that is not something I'm going to look forward to.
That's true. All right, well, we will enjoy these last few weeks of actual NBA games, and we will be back within the next few days with an NBA Finals preview, apparently.
Yeah, definitely. And in the meantime, Brian, don't die.
You too, man.